Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, March 18th. I'm Alan Shartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga OBGYN at Myrtle Street and the new physician midwife pregnancy care model at Saratoga Hospital. SaratogaHospital.org for more information. Joining us today is Dr. Nina Sachs. Nina, to me and to all of you. She's a WAMC fixture, retired from Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. She's to answer your questions about all things involving the gastrointestinal tract. It's going to be a busy hour, so be sure to get your calls in early at 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Nina Sachs, your calls and gastrointestinal tract.
14 hours.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Dr. Nina Sachs, our friend, joins us today to respond to your questions on gastroenterology. Now retired from Albany Gastroenterology Consultants, Dr. Sachs received her medical degree from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and completed her internal medicine internship and residency at Strong Memorial Hospital. She completed her gastroenterology fellowship at Albany Medical College as a board member of St. Peter's Surgery and Endoscopy Center. Dr. Nina Sachs, welcome back to Medical Monday.
Thank you, Alan. Glad to be here.
Well, to join today's conversation, everybody, and by the way, there's now 6 people on the phone out of 10. You don't see that very often around here. Give us a call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. My advice is, you want to know about stuff, call now. Get on the queue, and you can check in with your questions at via email at voxpop@wamc.org or tweet us at @WAMCVoxPop. But I don't know about tweets. Ever since the president started up with tweets, I'm not a big tweet fan. And much better to call 1-800-348-2551. Nina, it's colon awareness month, right?
It's colon cancer awareness month. That's right. And I just wanted to mention, we typically, for average risk individuals, meaning no family history of colon cancer or polyps, we generally recommend the screening begin at age 50, and that is changing, that recommendation. In fact, the American Cancer Society now recommends we begin screening at age 45. The reason for that is we are seeing an uptick in the incidence of colon cancer in younger individuals, 30, 35,
How
even
come?
In their 20s. We don't know exactly.
Probably eating garbage.
But you wonder about environmental factors. That's one thing. But we don't know exactly. So we're becoming more aware when younger people, 20s and 30s, present with rectal bleeding. We don't take that as just hemorrhoids.
Is that the number one way you find out if you've got colon cancer, if you've got rectal bleeding?
Colonoscopy, you mean?
No, just rectal bleeding.
That's one way, but it could be more likely, you know, gross rectal bleeding. That's not typically the way colon cancers present, except very low ones, like in the rectum or low areas of the colon. Usually it's more insidious, so it's occult blood, and that's why we test, you know, looking for hidden blood.
I understand that black stool is also another.
Black
clue.
Stool is typically digested blood. That could be a right colon cancer, but more likely that's more upper, so perhaps an ulcer or other things.
I've always thought, and you know, I always, one of the things I remember is that a guy was talking about toilets and said, never buy a black toilet because you won't be able to tell if your stool is black or not.
Well, you know, when you, if you have a bowel movement and look in the
bowl, and
the water has turned pinkish.
Yeah, that's
your
good
best
sign.
That's the sign that there's blood there.
Okay,
so
now
that's
folks, every
for.
Phone is busy, so we're going to have to get you all. We have actually one free phone, line number 10. So we're going to go fast. So don't be angry at me if I just say, okay, that's enough now. Here we go, Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Do you believe the sedentary lifestyle influences the gastrointestinal reflux disease?
Well, I think sedentary lifestyle would influence GE reflux disease if you're talking about obesity, increased abdominal pressure, which may predispose one to have reflux. Sedentary lifestyle sometimes goes along with a poor diet, fatty food intake, larger meals. So a healthy lifestyle would decrease your tendency to reflux.
Jim, do you exercise?
Well, a little bit.
That's not enough. Thank you, Jim. 1-800-348-2551. We go to Suzanne in Saratoga. Suzanne in Saratoga, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon, doctor. I recently had a colonoscopy, my second one, and they've discovered diverticulosis. And I've been, there's controversy in regards to dietary reasons. Some physicians say that to avoid nuts, seeds, corn, and whatnot, and others say it doesn't make any difference at all. So with your years of experience, I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Well, in 2009, a large study was done, published in Gut, which is a British medical journal, looking at thousands and thousands of people with diverticulosis, little pockets in the colon, and whether or not diet, in terms of avoiding seeds, nuts, popcorn, as you said, would prevent inflammation of those diverticuli called diverticulitis. And there was no evidence that diet played any role.
Interesting.
So, you know, I kind of come down a little bit. If someone has acute inflammation, acute diverticulitis, we would tend to go on more of a low residue diet for 8 weeks, 10 weeks or so, and then gradually reintroduce healthy fibers.
So what do you think does cause it, Nina? What do we think does cause diverticulitis?
Well, it may be immunologic. There may be immunologic factors. And bacteria, different types of bacteria. So the microbiome may actually have something to do with diverticulitis. So it's interesting. Also family history and age. So younger people with significant diverticuli, when they get diverticulitis, it tends to be more severe. But diet doesn't seem to, at least in the literature, does not seem to play as much of a role as we used to think when I started in practice.
Question asked, question answered. Thank you, Suzanne. And on to Diane in Orange. All right, Diane in Orange, you're on.
Hi, Nina. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Dr. Shattuck. I'm scheduled to have a colonoscopy and EGO tomorrow. On Friday. I'm not sure what to expect and what they're looking for.
Okay, so you're going to have a colonoscopy, which is an evaluation of your large intestine, and the endoscopy, EGD, is an evaluation of your esophagus, stomach, and the early part of your small intestine called the duodenum. I don't know if this is a screening test. Are they looking for polyps? Are they looking for ulcers? What were your symptoms?
I think they were looking for a low hematocrit.
Oh, so you have an anemia. So they're looking for perhaps a source of hidden bleeding, an ulcer, perhaps a polyp. You know, the most important thing is the preparation for the colonoscopy, because you want them to see every nook and cranny. So follow those directions to the letter. That's very important. Once you get there, they will take good care of you, and you will typically you'll have some type of a sedation, and you'll have a driver with you, and you likely will not remember much of the exam. But you do your part. Prepare well.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you very much. All right. And now on to Larry in Margaretville. Larry in Margaretville, your turn. Go.
Hi.
Hi, Gary.
About 3 years back, I got actually hospitalized. I ended up with blood in the stool, and I had both a endoscopy and a colonoscopy trying to find that. And I guess they found some erosions, and I ended up with symptoms of acid reflux, and I was on 2 years of omeprazole. Okay. I had a desire to get off the omeprazole, which was approved, but I'm wondering if, and I'm asymptomatic of reflux, like I don't notice anything, but I might be noticing symptoms, and I'm trying to figure out what should I be looking for to see if I should go back on the omeprazole.
So are you asking me what are the symptoms of acid reflux?
Yeah.
Okay, so what symptoms should you be looking for? Okay, so acid reflux is when gastric juices come from the stomach up into the esophagus, the food tube. And typically, you know, we talk about acid indigestion or discomfort in the chest after meals. Sometimes people get a little bit of stomach acid actually up in the mouth called pyrosis. Atypical chest pain, so chest discomfort after meals. But typically it's related in some way either to meals or to perhaps bending over, being recumbent, flat.
How about heartburn?
Well, heartburn is what is heartburn, you know? So it's some discomfort or agita that occurs, and certainly that could be one of the symptoms. Trouble swallowing. There's other atypical things like cough, and so it could be a myriad of symptoms.
Go ahead.
Did you have a question?
So, because I don't tend to get those symptoms, but they did find erosions in the esophagus in the past. So I'm not, with the endoscopy. So I'm trying to figure out if I should ask to see if I should get another endoscopy then.
Well, you know, certainly it's worth having a discussion with your physician. If you had erosive esophagitis, and you oftentimes that can heal over 8 weeks and perhaps and not come back, okay? But if you didn't have symptoms the first time, it's definitely something to discuss with your doctor. But you may not need another endoscopy. But I would certainly discuss it with the physician who did your original endoscopy, also to make sure you didn't have changes such as Barrett's esophagus, changes in the esophagus, which would make that of more concern. I think the other thing is to be careful with your diet, you know, not to overeat and so on and do all the things you're supposed to do. And also, when you were first diagnosed with erosions, were you on any medications such as nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or things that might predispose you to have those erosions? So I'd be thinking about that as well.
Okay, Larry, got to let you go. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Now, look, folks, we can't kid around. These phones are ringing like crazy, and I want to try to get to everybody that we can. This came from the interweb, Nina. I have mild gastroparesis, and as a result, I was not thoroughly cleansed from my last colonoscopy. What cleansing regime do you recommend to your patients who take a little longer to flush their systems? Many thanks, Jill in Newburgh.
Yes. So there are people for a variety of reasons who have what we call a sluggish GI tract and who may take longer. So what I would tend to do is do the preparation over more days. So instead of a one-day preparation, we have in my practice a two-day or even three-day preparation. So it starts a little with a low-residue diet, of course, and you may want to actually do that for 2 weeks before instead
residue?
Of 1 week. Low-residue, so a fiber that might stick around longer, we avoid that. So it's not so healthy, you know, such a healthy diet, but we avoid that in the week before colonoscopy. We may want to extend that longer and do the cathartics over a longer period of time. So there are all kinds of ways to manage that.
And also by the interweb, hi, question for the doctor. I'm 42-year-old female who has ulcerative colitis for 9 years. After my first pregnancy, I had a mild flare, but was able to control it with mesalamine.
Mm-hmm. Mesalamine, yes.
Yeah. After my second pregnancy, I flared off, and for over 2 years, I was able to control it initially with diet SCD, but eventually had to go on a biologic. The difference is I had a tubal ligation for my second pregnancy. Could this be triggering the flames, or is it merely coincidence? Most doctors I ask, GI, OB-GYN, general, all seem to say no.
I believe the question is, did the tubal ligation cause a flare? No, I don't think so. It's probably more likely that hormonal shifts caused the flare, and this flare just happened to be more aggressive, requiring more medication. It's not that unusual to have a flare after delivery.
On to Marcia in Menands. Marcia in Menands, your turn.
Hi, thank you. I have suffered from ulcerative colitis for 50 years now. I'm 74, and I had it when I was 24 for the first time. And now I've got a twisted colon, so I have to, when I get my colonoscopy, I have to get the MAC surgery, which I guess is more like a general surgery, or anesthetic, well, I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah, MAC anesthesia is not general anesthesia, but it's a monitored form, yeah.
Well, what my question is, at my age, at 74, I've been told I should get a colonoscopy every 2 years. And when do I stop getting a colonoscopy?
I'm just a
little afraid of the MAC.
I absolutely understand. However, if you have colitis in your entire colon, okay, so you have diffuse ulcerative colitis, your risk of dysplasia, changes in the colon, precancerous changes, and colon cancer is definitely higher than in the general population. So you are not an average risk person. An average risk person, we start thinking about colonoscopy after age 76, and we do it on a case-by-case basis. But in a higher-risk individual such as yourself, you could certainly discuss it with your gastroenterologist, but my own feeling would be to continue. You know, the monitored anesthesia is safe in competent hands. And it should be comfortable for you. It should be very comfortable for you. It's the preparation that most people object to be honest.
Yeah, that's not comfortable. I guess I was just worried, you know, sometimes you hear of elderly people, they never really come out of it. And I've had, grandmothers that happened.
Absolutely. And I would say to you, if you're a frail individual, you have other health issues, then that's a whole different issue. You know, people have kidney issues by certain ages. You know, 72 years old could be like a 40-year-old, and a 72-year-old could be like a 90-year-old health-wise. So that's why you want to talk to your doctor.
Thank you, Marcia. Yeah. All right, now let's go to Susan in Kingston. Susan.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
How are you? Yes, I had a question in regards to hungry all the time. I had a gastric sleeve, and I lost 50 pounds, but I gained it back because I'm always hungry. It doesn't matter what I eat, how often I eat, or how much I eat. It just seems like it's constant, 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 and it drives me crazy. I can drink water and eat, drink water, eat, and nothing satisfies that hunger thing.
Oh, that's a tough one. It's a tough one. Yeah.
Of course it is.
Oh, my gosh. See, I'm not quite sure why that is. Do you think, is there any anxiety involved or anything else that may be going on?
No, I get hungry.
Because your gastric,
an hour later, it's like I haven't eaten in 3 days.
Yeah, because your gastric capacity or the size of the remnant should be very small. So somehow that feedback loop isn't operating. And I'm not quite sure how to get you more, on track with that. Have you talked to the center where you had your sleeve surgery done to check and with the nutritionist?
I haven't seen him for a little while. A lot of things have happened that I wasn't able to get there. So now that I can, I'll have to make an appointment.
You should. And I think the other thing,
think that it would take care of that hunger thing. It starts with a G, Grulian or something.
There are some foods actually that will empty slower from your gastric remnant, from what's left. So that may help. Typically, yes, the size of the remnant and making it smaller should help. But it may be something to do with your particular surgery. So I definitely, you know, you may need further investigation, such as with an endoscopy, to make sure that your sleeve is still intact, you know?
No, right. No, I'm on this diet, which leaves me hungry most of the time. The question is, don't we have to just get used to being hungry?
Well, I don't know. It's so hard.
It is hard. It is hard, but
you
not
know, because I can drink a lot of water to try to help. But
that empties
work.
Very
you know,
quickly.
I'm getting a headache because I didn't eat.
Yeah, no, water isn't, you know, because that's going to empty very quickly. It may not be helpful. But some things that empty slower might help. I would talk to the nutritionist who works with your surgeon and also look at your remnant and make sure that it's actually that your sleeve is intact.
Susan, thank you very much. All right, now we're going to go to Bonnie in Denver, New York. Hey, Bonnie, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling about the difference between a reflux problem and Barrett's, which I do have the Barrett's. What's the difference between reflux and Barrett's?
Well, Barrett's esophagus is when the esophageal lining changes its characteristics and becomes more like stomach lining. And that can occur when acid bathes the esophagus, okay? And those changes can occur in some people, a small percentage of people. Acid reflux is very common, and Barrett's is much less common. The problem with Barrett's being a stomach lining, that lining can change over time to precancerous cells and then on to esophageal cancer. Okay, so that's why it becomes more of an issue. It also depends, though, on the length of the Barrett's. Some people have very short segments of Barrett's esophagus, no changes in the, you know, on biopsy, in the no dysplasia. And that's a more benign entity than someone with long segment Barrett's or Barrett's with dysplasia. So it needs to be monitored more carefully. Does that help?
Well, I've been told to come back. I was just diagnosed maybe 2 months ago, and the doctor said come back in a year for another endoscopy. Sure.
Yes, and over time that may extend. You know, so if you have a short segment of Barrett's and no dysplasia, over time that time frame between endoscopies is getting longer and longer. You know, you could look online. On Barrett's esophagus and screening recommendations, okay? And, you know, see, you know, your age and your characteristics and get more information.
Bonnie, thank you. All right, now on to Manny in Kingston. Manny in Kingston, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if the doctor could tell me, how do you know if your congestion in your chest is coming from asthma or from GERD?
Well, you can't always know for sure, okay? And sometimes GERD or acid reflux can contribute to asthma or can cause asthma, all right? And there are tests that can be done that can help. And those tests are called pH tests. So where a catheter is put into the esophagus and you kind of wear it. It's a little tube that sits there with a pH probe. And over time, your reflux is measured as you go about your daily activities, your eating and sleeping. And you you can even correlate that with symptoms such as asthma type symptoms. So there are tests that can be done to help with that, because that's very important, because aggressive treatment of reflux may help the asthma, but you don't want to treat reflux aggressively. It has nothing to do with asthma, which may be caused by a myriad of other factors. So there are tests that a gastroenterologist can perform to help differentiate that.
Thank you, Manny. All right, now on to Tara in Massachusetts on line number 9. Okay, Tara, you're on.
Hi. I've had a long history of gastrointestinal issues starting when I was 18 with lactose intolerance and then severe candida albicans that spread through my body. And now I'm almost 40, and about 5 years ago, I tested positive with a blood test that I was allergic to gluten and gelatin. And I finally, 5 years ago, stopped eating gluten. And a lot of my symptoms, all of my symptoms almost, have gone away. And my naturopath recommends getting an endoscopy, but the gastrointestinal doctor told me that because I haven't been eating gluten for 5 years, I will probably test negative, and my insurance won't cover it. It's like a $2,000 exam, and I'm trying to decide, is this something I need to worry about? And some people have told me that an endoscopy is invasive. So if I'm feeling better, just leave it alone. I just wanted to also add that the woman that called about diverticulitis, I was just reading a book called The Gut, and it had mentioned that in America, we sit down on toilets. We don't squat when we go to the bathroom. And in other countries where people squat to use the bathroom, there are really low rates of hemorrhoids and diverticulitis. I'd like to hear your thought on that as well.
Well, I'll answer that. I understand the hemorrhoids, and there's something called a squatty potty that is very popular here. You can buy it on Amazon. That kind of helps with that. Diverticulitis, not so much. Okay, I would be interested to look at what her, you know, what the basis of that opinion is. Diverticulitis, inflammation of the colon. I think if you empty, you know, you empty the bowels well, perhaps that was what she was talking about. But without looking at that specifically, I can't tell you. In terms of your gluten intolerance, it's unclear to me by your history whether you truly have celiac disease or whether you have an entity called gluten intolerance. Either way, a gluten-free diet is going to help your symptoms. But whether you truly have celiac disease, there are other blood tests, and there's HLA markers that you could do through blood tests that may help differentiate that. If you have certain HLA type, it would be more suggestive of celiac. And if you don't have certain HLA markers, it would be very, it would be almost unheard of to have celiac. So that might help. I agree with the gastroenterologist that 5 years on a gluten-free diet, you may not see the blunting of the villi in the duodenum that you should see with celiac. Sometimes you do, but your chances of seeing that and being able to determine that on biopsy are less. If you really want to know, you could do a gluten challenge over several weeks and then have the endoscopy.
What is a gluten challenge?
You eat so many slices of bread a day, you know, simple to
I couldn't even do that because I would, I have like the tiniest bit, I get so sick for 2 days.
Yes, absolutely. So for you, that's not an option, but perhaps some of the other blood testing might help differentiate that. The only reason to know is
HLA. Is that a DNA test?
HLA blood testing. Okay, so there's a certain certain types. It's just a simple blood test. But what I would tell you is that the only reason you'd want to know if it's truly celiac, then there are certain other autoimmune diseases you may be at risk for, and certain patients with true celiac may be at risk for other diseases such as GI lymphoma and so on. If it's gluten intolerance and you feel better, there's absolutely no reason to go further. Do you see what I'm saying?
Okay, Tara, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Talk to your physician.
Okay, now we have four people on the phone. We'll have time to take more phone calls. But first, I'm going to ask the amazing Zachary to take it away and bring it back. We are back. Thank you very much. We're here with the amazing, wonderful Dr. Nina Sachs. What a tribute to her. The phones have been ringing like crazy all day. Let's go to... let's see here. Yeah, Michelle in Saugerties. Michelle, your turn.
Hi. So my 23-year-old son's on Prilosec for GERD, and without it, he vomits. He's been diagnosed with depression prior to being on that, and I know that that could be a side effect as well of the medication. He knows he's been told he needs to lose weight, to help the GERD, but any recommendations to get him off of Prilosec or any other medications that you might recommend?
And what were his symptoms of GERD? You said he was vomiting? Is that what you...
He vomits. He vomits from it, and the Prilosec helps that.
And is he on other medications for depression or anxiety?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
And ADHD as well.
Okay, so some of those medicines could perhaps play a role?
No, he was doing the vomiting before he was on any medication.
Okay, so everything was started at once? Is that how?
Well, he had the symptoms of depression prior to that, but he wasn't taking any medication. The vomiting was going on for a while, and then he was diagnosed with GERD and told to take the Prilosec, which helps keep it under control.
Okay. All right. And you're concerned about long-term Prilosec? Is that the question?
Right, because what I've heard is that you shouldn't be on it long term, and as well as it can contribute to depression, which he already has.
Right, I understand.
And
sometimes the Prilosec or the omeprazole type medications can interact with some of the antidepressants, so you want to be aware of that as well and change their level, their level higher. So your doctor should, just make sure that the doctor who's prescribing the Prilosec is aware of the other medications and so on, and vice versa. So what I would say is, not knowing, your son's, his body type. And so there's so many other things I would want to know, but diet and lifestyle changes can make a big difference. So you said that he's been trying with his diet, and that's good to eat healthfully, smaller meals, not lie down after meals, that kind of thing. Otherwise, it's difficult. I would say you could try to go to the lowest possible dose of the Prilosec. So if he's on 40 milligrams, he should try to go to 20, and then maybe try 20 milligrams every other day, and just see what's the lowest dose that still controls his, assuming that this is reflux, these reflux symptoms. I'd also want to make sure if he's vomiting that there's not something else going on, such as poor emptying of the stomach.
Oh, he did hiatal hernia.
Okay.
Hiatal hernia is another recommendation he has. Diagnosis, yes.
Right. And did he have an endoscopy just to make sure that his, and looking for food in the stomach or signs that the stomach isn't emptying well. I mean, there's other reasons that he might vomit other than simply reflux. So I just want to make sure that we've covered all bases.
Okay. I'll check in with him and see what he has done because he doesn't live home. So
yes, I know. I understand. I'm a mother myself. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing I would say is there are weaker antacid medications. So let's say you could have the Prilosec dose and maybe add an H2 blocker, such as ranitidine, assuming there's no interactions with his antidepressants. And that's a weaker antacid medicine that has no risk long term. So you could kind of, with your doctor's help, those medicines could be adjusted. You see?
Okay.
Okay. I hope that
Thank
helps.
Thank you. I'll pass the info on to him.
Okay.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay. It's 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's see here. Now, holding on the longest is Ani in New York State. Ani, you're on.
Hi, yes. My son is 19, and he had fairly chronic diarrhea between the age of 15 and 18, and we couldn't figure it out until finally we had an infectious disease specialist diagnose him with E. histolytica, a parasite. Mm-hmm. Which he picked up in Asia, I think.
Okay.
And he was treated. He was treated for that successfully. So he no longer has that, but he now has kind of irritable bowel with a lot of gas, chronic gas.
Yeah.
So my question is really, as he doesn't live at home either, and it's hard. I just want to give him some gentle guidelines that, as a 19-year-old, he could actually fulfill.
Yes.
And also,
yes. Okay.
Also, I wonder, is there a connection between the gas and the E. histolytica or the treatment?
Okay. So I'm just going to assume right off the bat that he was treated for the Entamoeba histolytica and follow-up stool studies were negative. So we know that's been eradicated. And that,
yes.
And subsequent to that, his diarrhea went away, but he has a lot of bloating and intestinal gas. Is that kind of what we're...
Yes.
Okay. So what sounds to me like what he has is called post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome. So any insult to the GI tract, such as an infection of any etiology, okay, this is a particularly severe one that you're talking about, but any infection, E. coli or Giardia, can lead to an immunologic reaction in the gut, and the gut just becomes sensitive. And bloating and gas is one of those issues. Now, this hopefully will improve and get better over time. But I think in the meantime, what you want to do is make sure that the diet does not promote an increase in intestinal gas. So what he may want to do is look at avoiding sugars. You know, there's a diet called the FODMAP diet, F-O-D-M-A-P, yeah. FODMAP. Yeah. So it really eliminates many sugars and sugar alcohols and fruits and vegetables that are higher in simple sugar content. It's a rather complicated diet, and I'm not telling him to follow it to the letter, but to look at the high FODMAP foods and kind of avoid those and go with the lower FODMAP foods for a while. And I believe this will help his gas. The other thing is if he's doing anything with sugar substitutes, even gum or lozenges to stop that, they're really ubiquitous in a lot of foods that we eat. So I would look at the diet at this point, and particularly sugars and dairy, wheat, other things of that sort. He may need some guidance from a nutritionist.
Thank you, Annie. All right, and now on to Marie in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Marie, you're on.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Dr. Sachs.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling on behalf of my boyfriend who's been having abdominal pain, I would say sporadically, for a while now. And he's had so many tests, endoscopy, colonoscopy, blood tests, MRIs, and no one can seem to identify a cause. And I'm just wondering, perhaps this is too bad a question, but what might you suggest in terms of places to look for what might be causing this issue?
Okay. Can you tell me how old he is?
He's 59.
59. And what kind of pain is it? Is it after meals? Is it a diffuse abdominal pain? Is it upper, lower? You know, I mean, I could ask you probably 25 questions, you know, to try to get more information.
I know. I would say in general it's lower, and it's probably like an aching pain, I would say.
Okay, and it's there all the time, or it comes after meals, or after a bowel movement it's worse, you know?
I'm not sure there's a correlation there that I can identify.
Okay, so if I were to see someone like that who'd been through a lot of different testing, you know, I would try to review, you know, what has been done. And typically, if all the tests are negative, I would then say, you know, what other medicines are you on? What other health issues do you have? What is your diet like? Because diet can play a big role in this. But you really, the doctor would really have to be a detective. And it takes time. It takes time to ask the right questions. So, I mean, you just have to find a doc who's willing to spend the time. I mean, you know, it's not just about doing tests, you know?
What would you say, just one last question, about the role of stress, perhaps? Could that be a factor?
Stress can play, the mind-to-gut connection is powerful, and stress can play a role in most, in irritable bowel syndrome, gastrointestinal issues. So stress could be. And if that's the case, then there are certain stress reduction techniques, or many, that could be helpful. Okay, so that's definitely something to explore. But in a 59-year-old gentleman, I would want to make sure he had a thorough workup for other things before I attributed it to stress. But if it is stress, there's help. There's definitely help.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Okay, we're on. Alan had to step out for a minute. Let's go over to line three and Nancy and Wilton. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is very interesting because I have a history of gastrointestinal problems. I have two things that are unrelated. My GI doctor tells me I have a risk for colon cancer. They already took out the ascending colon. But I also have what they have diagnosed in the last 10 years as IBS. And you've just talked at length about this young man and the inflammation that maybe followed an incident. And my question is, when I was 15, I went camping. And I thought, oh, I'm the nature girl and all this. And so I went down to the stream and I, you know, drank all of that water and got horribly, horribly ill. And when I was being driven back home, I looked out the window and I saw that there was cows walking through the stream. And, you know, I never went to the doctor, but I was sick for a long time.
Yes, you may have had Giardia or some other, you know, infectious illness that you recovered from spontaneously. And since then, you've had irritable bowel symptoms?
Ever since then, I've had this problem with what they have diagnosed now in modern age as IBS.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, why would it last that long or is there a test that they can do now that might find a way to get rid of it?
I would say that irritable bowel syndrome in some people can be a lifelong issue, and in some it can go away. In your case, it may have been that issue. I would say the other thing I would want to attend to is if you've lost your right colon, okay, that's our water reabsorbing area in the colon, so that people who have lost the right colon may have more difficulty with diarrhea and colonic fluids and frequency. So that may be playing a role as well. But I've had patients who've had illnesses, infectious illnesses, and then had a lifelong issue with this, and others not. There is other testing that can be done, and that, you know, it sounds like you have a very good gastroenterologist that could follow that with you and perhaps do some other testing and perhaps suggest some other dietary measures and that may be helpful as well. So I wish you luck.
Yeah, the diet that you mentioned, some of it applies and some of it doesn't.
Well, that's absolutely true.
That's absolutely true.
It's as individual as, you know, I see so many people with this problem. And these diets are meant as a guide, okay? And you tweak them because each person is their own. And also stress can play a role. And there's all kinds of things to do for stress reduction these days as well. So,
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye, Nancy. All right, I'm back. Let's go to Rosemary in Hyde Park. Rosemary, you're on. 1-800-348-2551. We could probably take one or two more. Go ahead. Go ahead, Rosemary.
Okay, I have a quick question. I've been seeing lately a lot of these advertisements on TV for a product that you can use. It's implied that it's in place of a regular colonoscopy. And I wondered what the doctor's opinion was of this product.
Well,
I don't recall.
Good, because I finally somebody asked about that, because I really wanted to talk about other options for colon cancer screening. And I believe what you're talking about is Cologuard, which I'm also seeing a lot of commercials for.
Yeah, yeah.
And Cologuard is a test. It's a commercial stool test that looks at DNA, stool DNA, and certain tumors will colon cancer will shed little chains of DNA, and these can be analyzed. And if a positive test means you have those, it doesn't mean you necessarily have colon cancer, but it means you're at risk and should have a follow-up with a colonoscopy. How good is this test? This test also has an immunologic test involved called a FIT test, a fecal immunologic test that will also look at occult hidden blood that can also be shed by colon cancer, colon tumors, or polyps. So it's a dual test. It is covered by Medicare. Some insurances cover it, some not. For colon screening, you'd have to look into that before your doctor orders it. They would look into that and help you with that. It's for colon cancer screening, so for average risk individuals. It's not for people with a higher risk of colon cancer, family history, history of polyps. It's not for that. It's for your average risk individual. To begin at 45 to 50, and it's good for about 3 years. So colonoscopy, a good colonoscopy for 10 for screening, this for approximately three. I hedge because it used to be five, and now they're saying every three, so we'll see where it comes out. It does not have the same sensitivity and specificity as optical colonoscopy, but it comes close. It's a very good test.
Let me give you a couple of little facts. My last colonoscopy was 4.5 years ago. I'm 76 years old, and I had no polyps at all. So I'm wondering, what risk category do I fit in?
Well, if you have no family history of colon cancer or polyps, you've never had polyps, it sounds like you're an average risk individual. At age 76, if you're a healthy, vital person, you should continue screening. After 76, you know, it depends on your health and your desire, because then it becomes individualized.
So
according to the recommendations.
Can I get by with this Cologuard
It sounds
test?
Like you could do the Cologuard. Just check. Make sure it's covered. It's very expensive, okay? So just check.
I would
hate to see you get a $500 or $600 bill that you didn't expect.
And thank you, Rosemary. Okay, so unfortunately, we are now out of time. I'm going to try something risky. Gloria has, I'll set it up. Gloria has a teenager's GI issues on the spectrum and is rigid about food. So the question then, Gloria, is how do we handle this, right?
Yes.
Okay.
She's got a lot of issues stemming from her food rigidity and selectivity, and it's hard to get her to eat a balanced diet. She has almost no protein, but she has IBS and reflux, GERD. She's had chronic diarrhea.
Okay, I'm sorry for stopping you, because we are out of time. Nina, you see this from time to time.
I do. Could you maybe do something as simple as avoid wheat products or sugars? Or is there any way to disguise things and change them around or not?
Okay, we are out of time.
I wish I had more time.
Yes, it would take time. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody who called in. Apologize to those left on the line. Support for Medical Monday comes from MVP Healthcare, committed to making health insurance supportive, convenient, and personal. More information at MVPHealthcare.com. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Ray Graff was helpful. Stay tuned now for a news update.